Powered through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Bump and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Ross.
Here we go now.
Joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline, his newest article in the New York Times, The Remaking of the Seattle Mariners, is available to read now. It's Tyler Koepner. Tyler, first of all, thank you for joining us. Secondly, what prompted the making of this article? Where did the initial conversation and idea come from?
Well, yeah, thanks for having me. You know, I covered the Mariners as the beat writer for the old Seattle PI many years ago. In 98 and the end of that season, and then all of 99. So I've always kept a close eye on them and wanted to have them be good again. You know, like I wanted to come out there and write about this because I love the city and the ballpark and all that stuff. And I know, you know, I still know a lot of the people from there. So I did a similar story a few years ago when Kansas City broke their long playoff absence. And it worked out pretty well just to talk to, you know, some of the people who've been there a long time and could have perspective on what this really means to them. And with the Mariners, I also wanted to, you know, make sure I did some of the newer guys, newer people too, to kind of get a full flavor of what's been going on out there.
Hey, Tyler, question I have for you is, what is the perception of the Mariners? Obviously, you're a baseball guy. You follow and love the sport, so you're more in tune with what's going on. But on the other side of the country, we feel like we don't get a lot of love. What's the overall perception of these guys?
Well, I think what the Mariners showed, you know, a generation ago was that even in, you know, a faraway market, and back then it was much harder to see games, the Mariners can still resonate if they have just, you know, one young dynamic star. Back then it was Ken Griffey Jr. And now I think Julio Rodriguez is ascending to that level. Now it's obviously a lot to ask anybody to be Ken Griffey Jr. He's one of the greatest players of all time. But I think Rodriguez is the kind of guy who can, capture fans and give fans kind of a focal point for, oh, the Mariners, that's, you know, Julio's team. And then you start to pay a little more attention. I think from a national standpoint, you know, people understand that it's been a long, long time since they've made the playoffs and that, you know, they've got a good core going. And I think when you see them do things like, you know, trade for Luis Castillo and then sign him, you know, and have a guy like Julio Rodriguez and sign him, to go after the Cy Young winner and get him last year, Robbie Ray. I think that all is some tangible signs that they're really, that they really believe that this is their moment. And I guess it's going to start, you know, as soon as they clinch this playoff spot.
Your column begins by laying out kind of the building blocks of really the making of this team, the future, the legend, the architect, the voice, the historian, and of course the new boss, that being Katie Griggs, one of the newest members of this franchise. I wanted to talk a little bit about your choices for all of these people and how you saw their role in the rebuilding of this team, starting with what was most interesting to me, the historian. So what was Randy Adamack's role here? And what did you, if you learned anything, I'd be fascinated to know what that was, but I want to start there.
Yeah. Well, Randy, I wanted to find sort of the longest tenured team employee. And, you know, Randy retired in May, but he's still very connected to the organization. He's still working on some projects. And I know anybody who's come across the Mariners pretty much ever has known Randy because he's been there since 1978, second year of the franchise. So I really wanted somebody who stretched back all the way. I was also able to talk to a season ticket holder since 77. He's in that story too. And Matthew Boyd, who grew up rooting for the Mariners and now plays for them. So I wanted to get some voices who've been there from way, way back. And Randy really, has the longest history and could really talk about the Tom Pachorek commercial and the cat guy and all that. But really just, I mean, I was shocked. I think 18 games a year, or 17 or 18 games a year were on TV at the very beginning. And I knew that it was tough for the Mariners to gain some footing in Seattle. But, but he was able to kind of walk me through what it was really like back then. And I feel like even though this drought only dates to, 2001, it's sort of emblematic of a franchise that's always had a tough time. You know, nothing's ever come easily for the Mariners. So I wanted to get kind of a full perspective of the organization from Randy.
Tyler, do you think it's just the way the organization has done business over the past few years? Is it the Pacific Northwest not being attractive to players in the free agent market? What is it about Seattle that has made it tough over the years to kind of gain notoriety and get some of these free agents to want to come here?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting aspect that I didn't really have I wasn't able to really get into that too much, but I found it interesting that in this last 21 years, because I didn't really want to go through all the specifics as to why they didn't make the playoffs the last few years, the moves that didn't work out, the draft picks certainly that didn't work out, but there were free agents who came to town, you know, like, I mean, you guys know, yeah, Adrian Beltre spent 5 years there. Big player is going to be in the Hall of Fame someday. Richie Sexton was there for a while, big home run hitter. They were able to bring it. Robinson Cano obviously was a huge, huge contract. So they lay out the money and they were able to get certain guys. I think a lot of it's circumstance. I mean, that 01 team, if you remember, they had, John Olerud happened to be from Seattle. Aaron Seeley was good in the regular season. He happened to be from out there. So they had, they had some advantages there. I think part of it's just bad luck in the sense that they had three stars back in the old days with Randy and Griffey and A-Rod who were not from anywhere close to Seattle and really just, left during their primes. But just the way things work in playoff series, that team was good enough to get to a World Series and never quite did. And if they had, maybe we'd look at things differently. But hey, Edgar stayed and, they were able to have Felix's whole career be there, Kyle Seager's whole career be there. So I think they've really done a better job the last couple decades of retaining their best players.
For anyone who's wondering, Tyler has a section in the column about Edgar's involvement with the team and his role here. He's the legend. I wanted to talk about the architect, which is obviously Jerry DePoto. You detailed a conversation that he had with John Stanton about just kind of like ripping the Band-Aid off and resetting and the sacrifices that both Stanton and also DePoto knew that they would have to make. Would you consider that one a turning point when it comes to where the team is right now?
I really think so. Yeah. And I think it was important that they had a couple of successful seasons under Jerry right away, even though it wasn't really something that they could sustain, because I think it built up some credibility for him with the ownership and with the fans. Just the idea that they could get close and they could sort of revive some baseball interest in there. And then when it was time to do what Jerry really wanted to do and really had to be done, he had the ownership's backing. And now, sure, it's easy for the ownership to back you when you say you're going to cut the payroll, but it wasn't really about that. John Stanton loves Nelson Cruz. He wanted to keep Nelson Cruz, but it was Jerry's sort of vision that, look, this team, as it was constituted after that 2018 season, was just not ready and it was not good enough and they needed to really take a step back. And so once they were able to kickstart it with that Robinson Cano trade, putting Edwin Diaz in as a sweetener and being able to move on from that really allowed them to trade some guys who had a little bit of service time left before free agency. So they were able to get decent guys in return and Jerry has hit on most of his deals.
Last year, I think a lot of people around here felt that service got snubbed for the Manager of the Year award. This year, he helped this team go on a 14-game win streak. We've seen 7 games. They struggled as of late, but overall, how do you think, how well has service done? And do you think he should be up for it again this year?
Yeah, he's done a great job. I felt bad because I talked to him and wasn't able to get his comments in there, but he was very... he was very good in sort of explaining how things have gone up there, and he has done a great job. And you don't see managers get maybe as much time as Scott has had, to go through the the ups and the downs that they've had there with him and Jerry DePoto, but they're very closely connected. And I think there's a real sort of consistent message throughout the organization that's very important to Jerry and Scott, you know, communicates that and keeps what appears to be a pretty good clubhouse, you know, a pretty good group that, you know, that has the chemistry. So that reflects on the manager too. So I think he'll be up for it for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at like Cleveland and Baltimore and maybe their unexpected success as well, it's going to be a tough field.
Now, one of the fun parts of the conversation, obviously, it's Julio. Tyler, you're big time now with the New York Times.
But
you did used to cover this team. So when you compare, you know, iterations you covered or stars that you already know of, does it feel like Julio is the first superstar in a long time for you? I mean, how is he reminiscent of anyone else, or just how stark is the contrast in like what he could bring to what the Mariners have had for 20 years?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've covered a lot of big, you know, when you cover the Yankees,
right.
I cover the Yankees every day for 8 years. So you come across a lot of stars and in some ways he reminds me of sort of the best of both Alex Rodriguez and Derek Jeter, in the sense that Jeter always carried himself with a sort of self-assurance and, it was more than just self-confidence. I think he was very secure in who he is. And Alex was extremely talented, we all know, and very inquisitive and really wanted to always absorb all the information he could to try to get better. Now, Alex had a lot of other issues that you hope Julio doesn't have, but those good things about Alex, you know, were real. And I think those good things about Derek were real too. And if you can combine someone with something close to A-Rod talent, I don't know if Julio has A-Rod talent, very few people ever have. But if you can find somebody close to A-Rod's talent level with the, without the kind of insecure, nature that maybe led him to a lot of bad decisions, with Derek Jeter's sort of self-confidence, you got a heck of a player to build around. And that's kind of what I sense from Julio, is that, you know, he seems to really be comfortable in who he is, very loyal to the Mariners already, but also had enough sort of self-respect to know that, like, he signed a long-term deal, but he also bet on himself to reach certain thresholds, you know. So it wasn't like the Mariners came at him with like a low ball offer that insulted him. They came at him with an offer that both guaranteed him some security, but also played to his sort of self-confidence. And that if he wins MVPs and gets close and does all this stuff like he thinks he will, he's going to earn just massive dollars. So I felt like that contract said a lot about him and their relationship. And that's how Julio put it too.
All right, Mariners have 10 games to play in 9 days, no days off. All of these are at home with a chance for the first time in 21 years to get to the postseason, and better yet, to clinch that postseason spot at home. So what better way to get ready than to read Tyler's column, The Remaking of the Seattle Mariners? It's running today on the New York Times. I also retweeted a link to it if you want to just click directly on that and go check it out. It's a fantastic read. And Tyler, this has been a fantastic interview. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, this hour, Bump and Stacey's brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. Let's get to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with former Seahawks and Coug wide receiver Michael Bumpus.
First down, what has Kyler Murray done that will affect his relationship with his wide receivers?
This is what he did. Clip number four. Play that, Rod.
I tell guys all the time, always, like, never, you know, never, you got to be awake playing with me. Like, I mean, it's... Ooh. No matter what the play is, you know, I got free reign to do whatever, get into whatever. So when you're asleep and you don't think you're getting the ball, it's, you know, it's, we can't play like that. Everybody's gotta be lit up, you know, in the game, locked in, and we just gotta be better, and we will be.
You gotta be awake
to
play with Kyler.
You can't be asleep playing with me. You know what I mean? You gotta be ready to go. Now, here's the thing. He's not wrong.
Yeah.
he's saying real stuff. He will scramble. He will extend plays. He will find you down the field if you are available. But here's what he's not. He's not Aaron Rodgers, four-time MVP. He's not Peyton Manning, five-time MVP. He's not Tom Brady, three-time MVP. It's like those guys can come out and publicly criticize their guys because they have earned the right to do that. When you are Kyler Murray in the situation that he's in, you got to praise those guys, even if you're not completely happy with them publicly. Now, when you get into the locker room and you want to have real conversations, you're in the meeting room, you want to break things down, then you break things down. But he hasn't done enough to have that message be received by his receivers. Now I start to think, what if Hopkins was active and playing? Would he have said that? Even if he felt that way, you know, I think he looks at his receiving corps now and says, you know what, I'm the big dog on campus. I just got all this money. They got to listen to me. Now, he's a quarterback. He has to hold his guys accountable, but the resume just ain't thick enough for me yet. I'm like, all right, bro, like, you might be speaking real. This is the truth. But yeah. Win some more games. Win a playoff game. Stop the pouty face. And maybe you'll have a little more merit publicly when saying that. Other than that, man, in-house. Family business.
NBC Sports doesn't have the Arizona Cardinals anywhere near the top, not even in the top 10 in drop passes as a team. Instead, that group's dominated by the Jets leading the league in drop passes with 9. I don't know how accurate this one is because there are a couple teams on here that have 1 or 2, and I know they've had more than that having watched those games. But that being said, yeah, a great point. You got to have a resume to make that kind of statement.
Build it. Build that resume, son.
Only a handful of players that can. Second down. Giants wide receiver Sterling Shepard had a non-contact injury on grass. He's now out for the season with an ACL tear. Meanwhile, Odell Beckham Jr. expressed his frustration playing on turf. What's the difference between the surfaces? Which do you prefer?
So growing up in Southern California, I didn't see turf until I got into college. We played on grass all the time. Now, if you go back to Southern Cali, most of those surfaces are turf. The best grass I ever played on was at Auburn. That was like a beautiful fairway. You can fall on that thing. It's nice and soft. You're going to slide 10 yards. It's beautiful.
It's a pillow.
It's a freaking pillow. It's awesome playing on grass. And I prefer grass. The reason why I prefer grass, especially for a receiver, is getting in and out of your breaks. There's more give. You can dig into the grass, right? The dirt's going to kick up when you're trying to dig out of your routes. Now, with this artificial turf, there is some give, but it's just not the same. That's why you see these non-contact injuries a lot. We saw Odell Beckham go through it last year. The only time I feel like artificial turf is beneficial is when it's raining. I think the way it plays in the rain, you get more grip than you do when the grass is wet because it turns into mud. I understand all of that. But I'm going to go on and say, if you were to interview 100 football players, let's go specifically receivers and DBs and linebackers, running backs, the guys who are really making all these cuts and stuff, I'm going to say they're going to want to play on grass. It's more forgiving. It's real. And with turf, man, it snatches you. It bites you. And that's why we see a lot of these injuries.
So what's the issue with like a FedEx Field type thing? Because are they a grass?
Yeah, that's grass.
Okay. Is that just poorly maintained field conditions? Same with Soldier Field?
Yeah, poorly maintained. Now, I played on surfaces that looked poorly maintained on TV. Like UCLA, the Rose Bowl, you look at that, you're like, look, that doesn't look like great grass. But it just feels different. Something's going on in FedEx, man. I don't know who the field manager is, whatever his position is. But they got to figure something out. Something ain't right over there.
Third down. One of my favorite moments from the weekend. Bills offensive coordinator Ken Dorsey lost his mind, but he since issued an apology to the public and to his teammates. What's the good and the bad from this situation?
All right, here's the good first. The guy cares, right? He wants to win. He goes, man, we ran 90 plays. My quarterback threw for 400 yards. We should win this game. Possess the ball. Like, what else do we need to do? Also the good, whoever covered up that camera with his hand, that's his boy. He needs to take him out because I'm sure that tantrum continued after that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Now, here's the bad. You're an offense coordinator. You got to keep your cool, right? You have to be able to look at your men or talk to them when you're in those moments and keep your cool. Now, that's at the end of the game. I understand that. And then it's like the example that you're setting for the youngsters. You know what I'm saying? But I love the passion behind it. Like, you don't want them to get rid of that passion. This is the way you got to do it. Every coach in the NFL, 90% of them, I'll say, has had their moments like that, throwing a headset. I used to get, when I was coaching high school football, I used to tell my athletic director, I'm going to get one penalty a year to where I'm just going to lose my stuff. I'm on the field. I'm at the referee. Because sometimes you just got to send a message and let your boys know you got their back, right? And I once a year, I do that. I told my AD I'm going to do that. And football is such an emotional game. You do not want to be a robot out there. So it's a bad example, but this happens all the time in the NFL, any level of football.
Because we've got a couple minutes left for the question, I'm going to, for a fourth down, I'm going to throw on one more to this.
All right.
Is there an NFL coach you can think of where you're like, this guy needs to show more emotion?
Needs to show more.
Like, I'm wondering if, I don't watch a lot of Cliff Kingsbury on the sideline, but I'm wondering if he's one of them.
That's one of them for sure.
Yeah.
Kingsbury is like, he just looks like he's scared out there. Like,
well, there are some guys
I hope this works out.
There are some guys that are okay. Like, I never think Bill Belichick needs to show more emotion because he's kind of, his whole thing is kind of being.
Well, he shows stoic. That intensity.
Yes, that's in a good
different
way.
He's super intense.
Yes, you can tell he is thinking about one thing and it is winning that game.
Yeah. I can't really think of it, but I think everyone has had their time to do that.
Yeah.
Nathaniel Hackett, he's a guy. I've watched him on the sidelines. Just blank face.
Yeah.
Like, this moment is huge right now. Can I handle it? But emotion is part of the game. Like, you want emotion, good or bad. There's just a line that you can't cross.
All right, fourth down. I think Nathaniel Hackett needs a get back guy. And, you know, but like, he's never actually going to run onto the field. He just needs to fake it one or two times during the game.
He's a get hype guy.
Yeah.
Slap him on the rear end every now and like, come on, coach, get up.
Nathaniel, show emotion here.
Come on.
Fourth down, what do the Lions do that makes you nervous for the Seahawks? As a reminder, this is Seattle's upcoming opponent going to be in Detroit.
The Lions, the Detroit Lions, we talked about it earlier, but they run the football well, but Swift is out of there. So now they got Williams. They have shown the capabilities to move the football. And what makes them dangerous is that when you look at that logo, when you hear the Lions, it doesn't put any threat into your heart and to your soul.
Nope.
Like, it's the Lions. Now, I'm sure the Seattle Seahawks, they're watching film. They're seeing what they do offensively and defensively and getting ready for this. But running the football and putting points on the board, the Hawks have shown that they struggled against the run and they have allowed some points, especially late in the game, and some big plays. Those are the two things that I feel like can keep the Lions in the game if they are in the game late. So Hawks, man, just tackle. Fit your gaps, make some big plays. Geno, keep being Geno, and you got a chance here. So this is a different year for the Seattle Seahawks. Can't take nobody lightly.
I got to be real. I am nervous about the Seahawks facing the Lions, about easily chalking this up as a win. I don't think you can do that. I'm nervous about the Mariners facing the Lions. I think they'll have a spot clinched before that.
I hope so.
All right. It's Bump and Stacey. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. Mariners assistant GM Justin Hollander joining us next. Don't go anywhere.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studio, this is Seattle Sports Station. You're listening to Bump and Stacey.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union.
Very excited for our next guest, Mariners assistant GM Justin Hollander, joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Justin, a big 10 days coming up here. The Mariners with a chance and a really cool moment to clinch a playoff spot at home. What does it mean for you guys? I'll start there, to be able to have that chance at T-Mobile.
Oh, it's really special to do. I've been a part of clinching mostly at home, although one time on the road, and to be able to do it in front of your home fans, if we can win some games and get back on track, the energy, the vibe, I think the people here deserve to witness that and be a part of it. It just changes the vibe that that everyone feels. If people feel so connected to a baseball team after 6-7 months of following box scores and watching games and listening to games, and you know, it's an everyday sport, and so to have it happen at home, I think would be really special for the people here.
Justin, it's been a long season, and there was a time where it didn't look like the playoffs were a real thing, but then this team goes on a 14-game win streak, and it changes the perception of this team. Did it change the way you guys thought about acquiring talent after that run, say, like a guy like Castillo?
Are you saying you had doubt at some point?
Absolutely never, Justin.
Not at all.
How dare you?
The people did. You know, Stacey and I stayed positive.
Bump and I have never in our lives questioned this team or doubted this team.
I probably did. We ride the wave, you know, Jerry, myself, the entire front office, like everybody else does. We're not immune to that. You know, you want to believe in your process and what you think the players were coming into the season. And then the team tells you a story as the year goes on. And this year is certainly, it wasn't without its moments of frustration, like all teams go through or most teams go through. But I think once we got out of our little tailspin, I think they culminated right around the time that the Angels left here in May, and we just did not have a good 5-game series in 4 days with them. The group downstairs really took it upon themselves to charge forward and say, we're better than this.
And you have to listen to what they're telling you as the season goes on. And by the time we got to the deadline, the group downstairs was telling us, we're really good, help us. And we wanted to listen. We wanted to be responsive to that. And when you have an opportunity to acquire Luis Castillo, who is one of the best pitchers in baseball and has been for a number of years, those chances don't come along. You don't get opportunities like that. So we really wanted to embrace the moment and try and add to our team in a meaningful, impactful way.
Now, this wasn't a trade deadline acquisition, though a free agency period trade. And that would be obviously Eugenio Suarez, along with Jesse Winker from Cincinnati. We joked about doubt for the team, right? Like, there have certainly been times I've been pleasantly surprised. And honestly, Justin, Gino Suarez in his home run production has been part of that this year. I might be pleasantly surprised. Are you, though?
I would say I want to give a ton of credit on this one to our analyst group. They really, really believed that what happened with Gino last year was a fluke, that he showed real signs as the season progressed of being the player he's always been. Obviously, he was playing out of position and he was playing hurt for much of the season last year in Cincinnati. And our analyst group was really dialed on that this player is a very good player who did not have a good year, but showed you a lot of reasons to believe over the second half of the season last year. Those things are never foolproof. You never really know until you get them here. But really, since Gino showed up in day one and because of the lockout and the timing, it wasn't until spring training, basically, that he arrived. But since the day he arrived, he's just been incredible in every way. Incredible downstairs as an energizer and a leader in our clubhouse. Incredible on the field. His defense has been great for us this year. Really, really excited about everything he's brought to the table this year.
Now, Justin, you and Jerry are the ones making a lot of these decisions, whether it's extensions. In this case, we're talking about talent acquisition and trades. My only understanding of how this all goes down is from the film Moneyball. I have to imagine that when a scout and your scouting team and your analysts are telling you about someone like Gino Suarez, let's look at one acquisition, okay, right? Like the Gino Suarez, Jesse Winker trade, specifically with Gino. I have to imagine in my mind, Justin, that an analyst wheels in a whiteboard just like Jonah did, Jonah Hill. And he's like, Justin, Jerry, listen, look at these stats that I have on Gino. Is that what happened? Is it a binder? How do they convince you about Gino?
There was a whiteboard involved. We were in my office in spring training, which because of, like I said, the lockout, the nature of the, we sort of had a weird frenzy period right after the lockout ended for free agency and trades to be made because the offseason was so truncated and it basically ended December 1st. So for whatever reason, my office in spring training became the place where everybody piled in and we had ideas like, by the dozen, basically, and that was one of the ideas. So, you know, I wouldn't say there was like a piece of paper or a binder. You know, it's 2022,
true.
So we had computers that were open, but in video. But yes, we did. We did have a whiteboard. There were some charts that were put up on the screen. But yes, we not exactly like Moneyball, but not that much different.
Justin, there's no denying how close this team is. You see them when they hang out with each other, win or loss. They seem like a tight team. And we have a texter say that you have some of the same mannerisms as DePoto. How close are you guys and the rest of the staff, and how important is that when you're trying to build a championship team?
Oh, I hate this comparison. he has much better hair than me. I'm sure we do have some of the same speech patterns. I have worked with Jerry every year but one since the end of the 2011 season. And when you do these jobs, you spend a lot of time, way more time than I spend with my wife or my kids. Like, I spend that much time with Jerry. So I'm sure there are speech pattern similarities or hand motion similarities. And I'm not sure whether they're his that I'm copying or mine that he's copying, but they are there. It's unfortunate. But yeah, when you spend that much time together, you do end up connecting in more ways than just, you know, over a meal, you'd start talking alike, you start using the same expressions.
I like to think of you guys sitting, you know, like in your office, which has become the de facto idea room, right? Someone walks in, you're like, what trade are we talking about now? And I like to imagine you and Jerry simultaneously just doing the same actions and people watching, like you guys sip your coffee the same way. And they're like, this is uncanny. It's just crazy what they're doing.
I don't drink coffee. So that one we don't have to worry about.
Justin.
But yeah, no, it's not like the thing where it's not like the thing where, you know, you see on Twitter or Instagram where there's, you know, there's two people doing the exact same thing at the same moment. It's not really like that, but where, you know, I'm certain there are speech pattern similarities. We don't really dress alike. You know, we don't live near each other. So we try and separate as much as we possibly can.
I'm just the only thing I stopped at. I don't drink coffee knowing that you're an assistant GM and how many hours you dedicate right. to that. I can't believe that.
Lots of soda, unfortunately, but no coffee.
Fair.
What's the celebration going to be like if and when this goes down? Are you guys, is it going to be celebrated like it's a huge accomplishment? Do you just say, okay, this is what we were supposed to do, on to the next? What do you imagine that moment being like?
I'd like to think it'll be more organic than something I'm planning out, but I guess for me personally, I will probably get after it because it is a huge accomplishment, mm-hmm. and then we will focus on the actual goal, which is winning the World Series. Getting to the playoffs is a big deal. You know, my first couple years in baseball, I just thought that's what you do because that's what I worked for the Angels and we made it both of my first 2 years and we won 100 games and then 98 games. And it's like, oh, this is easy. Right. It's not easy. It is. It's really hard. And when it doesn't go your way, it takes a whole year to try and right the wrong and get back to the point where you do have a chance to make the postseason and then ultimately win the World Series. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of blood and sweat and tears and whatever cliche you want to use to get there. I mean, we talked earlier about the ups and downs of this individual season. Think about the ups and downs that people have experienced that have worked for or been with the Mariners over the last 20 years. Obviously, we have work to do in front of us. If we do meet our first goal, which is making the postseason, we should celebrate. And then we should move on to the next goal, which is winning the first series that we're in. And then the next goal would be winning the next series. And ultimately, our goal is to win the World Series. And that, you know, you celebrate each individual accomplishment while not losing sight that the ultimate goal is being the last team standing.
All right. Leaving you with the last word there. Perfect way to end this conversation and get people primed and ready for the 10 games we got coming up here. He is Mariners assistant GM Justin Hollander. Justin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks.
All right. So I have good news.
Okay.
Katie is currently outside.
Is she?
And she has teal.
Saving you.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
saving you.
Mariners winning tonight, confirmed.
There goes my hero.
That's exactly what it is. Okay, so we move the timeline back. Get into the timeline next, and we have an update on a team mascot being unveiled. That's next.
This is The Timeline.
With Bump and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Mariners are back in action tonight against the Texas Rangers. First pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Pregame show starts at 5:30 p.m. right here on Seattle Sports Station. And that's Around the Diamond brought to you by Shane Company. Oh, and by the way, they're going to win because it's Teal Tuesday.
I have teal. Somebody save
well,
you.
No. Wow. Katie's outside, but we're in a segment now, so she has to sit and wait. Sorry, Katie, but she did bring teal, okay? The entire MacJack's text line is like, Katie deserves Mariners tickets. Katie didn't want Stacey to get fired. She still needs to pay rent next month. Okay, the good news is that someone just dropped off a teal junior golf glove.
Yeah.
They got you looking like your name is Meredith and you golf every Tuesday at the same golf course.
That's exactly
every
what it is.
Same time.
That's exactly what it is. I just say like, okay, I'm going to go see the girls.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I got to wear it. It's still Tuesday.
There you go.
And Meredith's still shooting a 77.
If the Mariners win tonight, I'll tell you who it's on. Everyone who wore teal at home, Curtis Rogers, Michael Bumpus, and then also whoever sent this glove
and
Katie.
And
that's
glove.
How important Teal Tuesday has become is that we've got just heroes among us that are willing
Seriously.
To just send us anything.
We're doing it for the playoffs.
Yeah.
Let's go.
This is for the
Absolutely.
Playoffs, you guys.
Teal Tuesday's
playoffs.
Real, man.
See how important it is, Stace?
Yeah.
You feel it?
Oh, I see it. I see it. Well, speaking of the playoffs, let's go ahead and get started here. The Spurs head coach, Greg Popovich, had a very honest assessment about his team's NBA title chances for the upcoming season.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I'll say it anyway. What the hell? Nobody here should go to Vegas with the thought of betting on us to win the championship. And I know somebody will say, gosh, what a Debbie Downer. There's a chance. What if they work really hard? It's probably not going to happen.
Ouch.
I mean, is he wrong? long.
No, he's not.
Spurs with also one of the longest playoff droughts. I mean,
no, they've been one of the most successful franchises.
Who am I thinking of?
Yeah,
they're thinking of the Kings.
Oh,
Kings,
yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah.
What, 15 years for the Kings?
Yeah, yeah. They have the second longest behind the Mariners.
Why did I say Spurs?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why I said
tell
that
me,
either.
Who's Trey Jones?
Yeah.
Devin Vassell?
Couldn't tell you.
Doug McDermott.
That's a fake name.
Oh, Dougie McBuckets, yeah.
Dougie McBuckets, okay.
Well, they traded DeJounte Murray, who was their only really good player.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they seem to be wanting to tank.
They're young. They're young. And Pop is real. That's real. And
yeah,
when you've had the success that he's had, you can do things like that. How many championships you got? Five?
Five.
Like, come on, I got five, man. Coach Hall of Famer. He's got David Robinson, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili, who bought the Euro step to the NBA. Like, he can do things like this.
Well, according to my math just now, thinking of the Kings, it's zero, actually. I think most people would say, wow, that's a horrible way to approach it, but I think it's just honesty, and I think that kind of honesty
Pete
and authenticity.
Ever saying something like
absolutely
that.
Not.
No,
I think Pete Carroll. But the thing is,
and they're
it's
both
still,
equally, they're both great coaches.
Well, and I think they're equally authentic in this moment. I think for Greg Popovich, he's like, "Look, we're not." And for Pete Carroll, I think Pete Carroll truly thinks, like, "Yeah, I think that we can do this." Bump, am I wrong? I mean, you've played for him, you know him well, you've covered this team as an analyst.
You're talking about Pete.
Now, I think that he is more optimistic publicly.
Yeah.
Because he's not one to ever throw a player under a bus or do anything. But I think that he has such a core belief in winning that he thinks it is possible in many, many circumstances.
I think he knows this year the odds are against them. For sure. I don't think he walks in into his first coach's meeting and says, "All right, boys, roll to the Super Bowl. Let's go." He goes, "All right, no, if we can do these things. If we can run the ball, if our quarterback can take care of it, if our defense can be lights out, let's get into the playoffs and let's see what happens." Whereas Greg Popovich is like, "Man, it's a long season. Got a bunch of young guys over here. Let's just be real." And he's kind of like Phil Jackson, to where he says things publicly to motivate his team as well. So he's trying to get the most out of his guys, but he's right. They ain't going to the finals.
Yeah. All right. On to another team that is well familiar with the finals and with the playoffs will certainly, in my mind, be there this year. The Packers, right? The Packers and the Bucks. Aaron Rodgers told Fox's Tom Rinaldi that Tampa-Bay's Jumbotron gave away the Bucks' game plan on their two-point try at the end of the game.
What was going through you during the two-point conversion, especially after you saw the fact that they took the five-yard penalty?
Well, they should have on the previous play, too. It was a delay on both plays. But sometimes you see things in the game. Sometimes the Jumbotron shows things they probably shouldn't show, even at home. I saw something and just passed on the information.
What do we think he saw?
He might have seen a personnel package. He might have saw a play sheet. I mean, it's not like they have plays drawn up on their call sheets.
No.
You know what I mean? Or he saw just a formation. I mean, he's MVP, right? He sees the game differently. But if he says the people at home, he alluded that the people at home might have been able to figure that out. It's something really specific to
right?
what they're trying to do.
So at first I was thinking, what if it's just like a very – like. Football players grind tape all the time. They will see things instantly that regular people don't. What if it's just something as simple as like, hey, here's an automatic review of something that I can look at and see and analyze. But that also happens at every stadium. Every stadium has replays.
Yeah.
I need to know what it was.
Me too. I'm curious.
I need to know.
Four-time MVP.
Yep.
He sees things.
All right, last story here in the timeline. The Seattle Kraken, now in the preseason, taking on the Flames tonight at 7, will finally be unveiling their team mascot, days away on October 1st.
I feel like it's going to be the most uncomfortable outfit.
Like squid.
Oh.
Like, it's just going to be too big.
Mm-hmm.
You can't walk down the aisles.
Yeah, knocking kids over.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what this looks
like. Eight tentacles.
Yeah.
So we're thinking it's going to be like a Kraken. Because some teams do this.
Seems
well, but
to
I'm
be
just saying, some teams do this like weird little, you know, like the Phillies have the Philly Fanatic.
Yeah, like a little creature. Like the Flyers have Gritty.
I was going to say
maybe the second most famous.
Second most famous.
Now.
And
like the Mariner Moose.
Wait,
Moose is not a seafaring
creature that you know of. I mean, I see them cross lakes all the time on National Geographic. They swim.
Smooth, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're bigger than you think, man.
Things are huge.
So I guess it doesn't have to necessarily be like a kraken or a squid of some kind, but I feel like that would be the logical
Yeah.
Maybe it has step. Like the face, like, what is that? Pirates of the Caribbean? What's that?
Oh, Davy Jones?
Yeah, oh, like the thing is like the teeth or whatever?
It has like the tentacles as a beard.
Ooh, like
you know what I'm saying?
Davy Jones. Davy Jones.
Yes.
Yeah. I would be okay with that. Yeah. So it's actually like a, it's like kind of like a humanoid.
Kind of spooky,
yeah.
though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I dig it, though.
Take pictures with children.
Yeah, no, I hope it's horrifying.
Give it big eyes and a smile. And
well, we're going to find out what it is on October 1st. That's not that far away. All right, we're going to get back to Seahawks next. Going pretty heavy NFL. We got Hype Train coming up because at 1 p.m., Scott Servais is going to join us for the Scott Servais Show. It is all Mariners from 1 to 2. You already know we're going to ask whether we're going to see Geno in this lineup tonight. Let's hope so. Fingers crossed. Don't go anywhere.